substance superior to its elements had they not been so united in that form and conformation. Thus, according to the Greeks, Zeus, who is not a person, but represents the archetype of these attributes of beauty, order, power, authority, dominion, law, order, number. That Zeus, therefore, is captured not as a person who will speak through the lips of the image, but as a power remote in space, but proximate in all things similar to itself. For as surely as God as life is revealed through everything that lives, as surely as God as generation is revealed in all things generate, as truly as God as truth is revealed in all things essentially factual and substantially true, so all virtues in themselves distant, invisible, and intangible are curiously captured and held by their similitudes and by their natural forms and orders. This carries us, then, to the reason for a talk about Zeus, which is not our main subject, but to bring us back for a moment to a statement in the Bible. And God created man in his own image. Now, this is our point. The great Zeus of Phidias is a sublime body, artistically conceived in the similitude of a deity. Man is a divine body, creatively fashioned in the similitude of a divine being. And if the sublimity which attached itself to the Olympian Zeus brings with it a certain sympathy, then man, in all his composite nature, in all of the symmetry and dynamic of his structure, in all the magnificence and order of his functions, in all the gallantry and beauty of his potentials, this being also cannot be remote from or separate from those principles which are personified and embodied by itself. Therefore, man likewise, as an image of divine things, by the nature and proper constitution of his soul, is a habitation of divine things, to use the Greek term. Therefore, there can be no essential interval between God and that similitude of God, which is man or creation, with man as one of the most perfect, geometrically obvious examples of the wisdom and dynamic and the canon of divine creation. This causes man to stand in a certain relationship to the gods. This relationship was very important in Greek religion. If, therefore, man is so constituted that he may be a receptacle of divine energies, if he is therefore likewise capable in his own life and nature of bearing witness to the attributes of deity, we will then pause for just a second and go back to our Olympian family. Here we have the gods up on the mountain, and these Olympian deities are 12 in number. These 12 representing to the Greeks the primary dodecahedron, or the great 12-faced symmetrical solid, representing symbolically, and we might almost say in terms of a mandala, the perfect order, the perfect balance, the perfect interplay, the perfect geometrical harmony of the total divine power. This power, one in essence, 12-fold in manifestation, therefore manifest through archetypal qualities. Each of these qualities being basic or essential in nature. One of the 12 creating powers which the Greeks and Romans later associated with the zodiac, or the 12 great orders of archetypal creative energies. It would follow, according to the Greeks, therefore, that if these 12 principles, existing universally in their own light, but existing archetypally as 12 fountains, cores, vortices, centers of creativity, that these extended principles moving toward generation or moving towards productivity would present 12 archetypal forms referred to by Plotinus as effulgent blossoms suspended in space. Such being the case, we then follow the Greek thinking that these 12 produce from themselves 12 kinds of souls, not greater nor less than each other, but possessing a peculiarity, namely that their perfection is by the dominant perfection of a certain power, a certain virtue, and that their harmony, their adjustment, their integration, their organization, these things are brought about by their ascendancy toward and unity with the creative principle from which they are dependent and to which they essentially belong, and over whom this principle abides as the shepherd or psychopompus of an order of souls. The Greeks therefore declared that in complete spiritual democratic equality, man possessing attributes divine, but at the same time by his very nature not complete or total in all his parts, may therefore be regarded as being suspended from certain deities, and that these deities are his fathers, that he is their child, that they are his father stars, that they are the causes and proper sources of himself, that his involution is departure from the knowledge or realization of this into a state of darkness or ignorance of his own origin, and evolution is his restoration again to identity with the shining vortex of the principle which is the core principle of his own nature. This means, or meant to the Greeks, therefore, that man belonged to orders or kinds, so that all men, while able to become physicians, would not become physicians by choice. For one man would choose to be artist, another architect, another physician. In the course of his evolution, and in the course of rebirth, he may become all of them. But even so accomplishing and so becoming, there still remains within himself a parent choosing, a core of desire, by means of which there is one universal aspect of the good, which curiously invites him more than others, and by which he is most stimulated to the attainment of the good. Therefore, in the end, instead of all persons or beings becoming alike, they will return to a 12-fold hierarchy to be available for the further manifestation of orderly diversity in nature, but not deficient in any of their own parts. The Greeks firmly believed this. They believed, therefore, that while we all have an equal destiny, that we all have a kind of destiny of divine and perfect accord, we are by nature inclined to a certain diversity of equality, and that while we may all gain philosophic insight, some will not choose to return home by philosophy alone. They will choose another road. One will become true to his farther star through the healing of the sick, another through the building of a house for his neighbor, another still by mastering the mysteries of the sea, still another by pertaining to great oratory and art, each one in his own way, fulfilling the peculiar core purpose of himself, but discovering that this core purpose cannot be accomplished without the assistance of the attendant muses or godlings, which represent all other powers necessary to the completeness of the dodecahedron. In other words, in each person, 11 powers cooperate to perfect a 12th. They become the servants of it. There are 12 possible cores, each of these cores surrounded by the other 11, so that each individual, by all paths and methods, still leads to a peculiar central focus of himself. That this central focus, therefore, brings him home to one of the gods, brings him home to one of the great powers that are not deities in person, but are the great archetypal patterns by means of which life is precipitated into the state of existence. Each person, then, has a pattern, a keynote, a tone, a color, a vibration, by which he has a certain uniqueness. But this is not inequality. This is variety in unity. If, therefore, man, becoming embodied in this world, begins to aspire towards a superior state, he may then, under certain conditions, seek to achieve beyond the common achievement of his time, pressed on by inevitable fate, by providence, one of the most powerful of all archetypes. Pressed on by these considerations, the individual immediately seeks identity with the natal demon. He cannot rest until he has achieved the most that his nature permits. Another man beside him has no such unrest and will continue for an indefinite time to live according to a series of compromises. Each person, however, even at the beginning of his search, will be first pressed to this quest by something in particular. For he will not move until the quality which belongs to his father star is moved in him. One man, therefore, will discover this pressing move on a battlefield. Another will experience it in parenthood. A third in art. Another in medicine. Whatever these symbols may be, there is always one door that opens into the mysterious and fabulous many-gated temple of Thebes. There are an infinite number of gates, but each man must enter by one. Also, there are 12 gates in the holy city of the New Jerusalem, so that the 12 orders of souls may come in. And the tree of life and the tree for the healing of the nations bears 12 kinds of fruit that no souls may go hungry. The thought has been carried on through, but we've lost track of it because nobody bothered to think what these symbols might imply. If therefore the soul or the mind comes therefore finally to the union with the essential daemon, and then gradually by the various disciplines ascends to the rational power, attaining perhaps the nature of the essential daemon, it then stands like the ancient archangel upon the clouds looking out upon eternity. For man, having completed the possibilities of the reflective life, has gone as far as certain elements or factors of his nature will permit. It is then that there is left to him only that which is beyond himself. And it is then and then only that, according to the rituals and the rites, man is placed upon the beginning of the great road that leads from what we might term personality directly to principle. And this road is the journey. It is the dark night of the soul, this journey of St. John of the Cross. It is many mystical experiences. It is likewise the mysterious road of St. Hildegard of Bingen, whose strange and wonderful symbols were beyond the contemplation of the centuries in which she lived. But here comes the new equation. In the Greek mythology, it is said that under certain conditions, the gods descend unto mortals, unite with mortals, and breed a race of heroes. Now, the hero in the Greek is also a very interesting and compelling symbol, because in every instance, it is the union of a principle with a body. It is furthermore the identity that we find in the statue of Zeus and the archetype behind it. The great conqueror could not have been moved had not the archetype taken form. And the form could not exist had the archetype not been projected. So the union of archetype and form is found in correlation or correspondence in the nature of man. For we know, as the Greeks tell us, that the hero is the immortal mortal, that the hero represents a divine archetype impressed upon matter. What then do we recognize this to be? We have discovered that the body bear such an impression. We have discovered that the senses, the faculties, the functions, the attributes, all bear witness to this impression. We know that the mind, the emotions, and the rational faculties bear witness. But these all bear witness to certain aspects only. The mind bears witness only to the sub-archetype of intellect, not to the total archetype. What then is the total archetype? What is the total impression of the divine purpose upon matter? And the Greek said that this impression, the total impression of the archetype upon form in the generation of a compound complex being in whom actually or potentially are all the attributes of the archetype, that this being is substantially invisible, but is nevertheless related intimately to and identical with, so far as such identity is possible, the personal and natural body of man. Man is therefore a being extending from the visible parts of the archetype, which are its inferior parts, to those invisible parts which are its superior and causal parts. And the total impact of the divine creative power upon the total man who therefore comes into existence as one being, with infinite diversity within him but undivided, bearing witness to an archetype containing infinite diversity but undivided. That the total impact of this is the union of a god and a mortal, and the production of a hero. The hero, therefore, is nothing more or less than the total being of man. Not his mind alone, not his emotions alone, not his energies alone, not his contemplative mystical experiences alone, but the total visible and invisible spirituality, intellectuality, and physical existence of man. Man totally, with every resource, every potential, in whose nature the 12 powers reside, and in the center or core of which one of these powers is sovereign over the others, forming with them a celestial order, a hierarchy. A hierarchy which in the process of man's evolution will gradually be externalized as a series of hierarchies and a series of archetypes, but which man in turn, by his own growth, will gradually move in upon until he becomes progressively aware of the 12-fold nature of himself and his own divine structure. The creature, therefore, the hero, is the total being as remarkable from the separate being, because the separate being is incapable of the heroic estate. The mind can go so far and must perish. The emotions go so far and then betray. The reason goes so far and then stands upon the borders of the unknown. Faith carries man beyond reason. A pure and complete Eastern concept of a samadhic or nirvanic state carries man beyond faith. But still, he has no certainty that he has exhausted the archetype. He does not know that this archetype is other than that it is total being, as absolutely different from any part of itself, and yet complete in itself. That all parts become chemically dissolved in the production of a thing different from themselves, but containing them all and superior to themselves. So we have the hero. He is therefore like the story of every man. He is the total truth seeker. He exists for two purposes. First, that the way of God may be made known. That is the motion downward of the law. And the second thing is that he himself shall return to his father's house, or return to the full statement of his own nature. By the descending of his own potential archetype in all its aspects, he gradually transforms himself into the living sanctuary, or the ecclesia. He is the church and the worshiper as one. He is the priest, the congregation, the altar, and the deity, all in one, undivided, of which all congregations, priests, altars, and deities are man's attempt to objectify archetype. He creates around him the similitude of the eternity within him. And every time he looks upward in the search of God, he is facing the eternal Olympus. He can look in no other direction. Of these deities of which we wish to speak, therefore, we can choose certain examples in the Greek legendary and lore. Among the most important of these archetypal heroic beings, the most important to us, are such heroes as Jason, the father of the Argonautic expedition that was searching for the Golden Fleece. The Golden Fleece, of course, represents the skin of the celestial ram. It is also, of course, if we want to go still further in it, it is the symbol of life, of truth, of wisdom. But perhaps most of all, it is the way of the god Ars, who is the lord of this. Therefore, in the case of Jason, we have a hero ascending according to the hierarchy and archetype of Ars, or Mars, going home through that path, searching for his father star, which is the constellation of the Ram. In this case, what does Jason do? Jason, having built his ship, and having resolved upon the great Argonautic expedition, seeks around him for the noblest and most valiant of the Grecians, and selects 12 who are to accompany him on the journey. And these are called the Argonauts. These 12 are archetypally the great circle of the gods. A little less archetypally and more within our own comprehension, they represent 12 powers resident in the human soul, the 12 attributes or energies by means of which the quest for the Golden Fleece is to be made possible. Therefore, the expedition starts out, and it is rumored that in that expedition, a very wonderful and mysterious being also accompanied them as one of the great heroes, and that being was Orpheus. And it is also told to us that Minerva assisted in the expedition, all of these representing the attributes of the psychic self and of the archetypal world, uniting in the hero quest. So Jason becomes the individual who, moving from the lesser to the greater rites of the mysteries, faces the great division of the Eleusinia into 12 degrees, through which the great labors must be performed, which are again paralleled by the other solar hero, Hercules, who is the hero of the order of the god Apollo. Now in the Greeks, when the priests in the temple, by their methods, which we do not fully comprehend nor know their means today, anointed an infant into the mysteries, for the newborn babe was also consecrated, these priests are said to have given to this child its sacred name, the name which might not be used in the reference to the child, a name which must be earned. The American Indian had the same habit. But that this name was actually the key to his father's star, so that physically he might be the son of, might be some Roman, like the son of Glaucus or Claudius. But in the temple, he was the son of Hermes, or of Zeus, or of Juno, or of whichever of the orders of deities his father archetype belonged. For as a person, he was born of the earth, but as a hero, as a total being, he was the child of heaven always. His body might come and go, he might live a thousand embodiments, but still he was the son of the Father God to whom he was indebted for the archetypal impulse. Therefore, we understand perhaps why the Emperor Julian always declared that he was the son of Mercury. This was because of the fact that he was an initiate of the mysteries of the great Oriental Diana of Ephesus and had received the mystery of his star or archetypal identity. And the Greek uses the word star in two ways, not only to symbolize astrology, but rather effectively archetype, because your star form, your magnificent blazing crystalline pattern, like a snowflake, is a beautiful symbol, a pure archetype. It is about as near as we can come to it. So these were the star archetypes which perhaps blazed in the invisible heavens of the gods as flowers upon the meadows of the sky. The Greek poets so referred to them. The most famous, of course, of all the heroes is Ulysses or Odysseus, who belonged to the celestial archetype of Poseidon, lord of the sea. Therefore, when Ulysses began his journey home from the Trojan War in the plains of Ilium, we know that the ancient name of Troy was Ilium, from Elis, meaning mud, earth, slime. Here is the same meaning as the parable son of the prodigal son and his flesh pots of Egypt, also the archetypal symbol of mortal or physical existence. That when he started to return home, Ulysses or Odysseus had to pay his debt to Poseidon, his father star. In other words, this star, for his return journey, became his judge, because nothing might be accepted back into the archetype except that which was consistent with the archetype. Any fault, failing, or weakness against the archetype became a peril, and this peril had to be met. And this peril, like the labors of Hercules, is represented by one of the adventures along the way, one of the temptations, for all these temptations are simply symbols of the initiatory ritual, which in turn is the symbol of the evolution of the hero self. Now, the hero self, having gone along through some of these testings, seems to come under most evil times. And in the case of Ulysses, who started out with a considerable company, representing attributes, qualities, achievements, and attainments, finds that in the end he must proceed alone. For all things not pertaining to the hero self are lost along the way, although we start with them. And the hero self comes finally home to Penelope, who is weaving the mysterious tapestry of fate, a tapestry which she unravels at night and weaves again the next day to keep away the false suitors until her lord can return. Now, of course, in this case, Penelope represents one of the primary attributes of the higher archetype. She is Sophia. She is the mysterious Helen of Goethe's Faust. She is the blessed damosel. She is Dante's Beatrice, who finally leads him into the Paradiso. She represents the highest aspects of his own now immortalized soul to which he returns. It is for this reason that Plotinus, writing to his friend, congratulates this friend because his son has come to study with him. And Plotinus says he rejoices that this young man has resolved to make philosophy his journey, and that he also, like Ulysses, seeks to spread the sail of his little ship and return to his own far distant native land. This is the journey of the hero. The hero, therefore, represents the immortal mortal. He represents the mysterious image with feet of clay and head of gold. He represents this mysterious being upon whom both heaven and earth turn like wolves upon a helpless being, apparently to rend that helplessness to shreds. And yet, by the continuous and marvelous intervention of the deities themselves, the hero is miraculously preserved until his labor is accomplished, always assuming, however, the sincerity of his own purpose and his own desire. Now, another point that is interesting in connection with the heroic legend is that in the majority of instances, or in many instances at least, the hero comes, like Hercules, to a tragic end. Now, this is true not only in the hero myths of the Greeks, but in the hero myths of most all peoples, because the whole strange world upon which men build, and which must ultimately be strangely shattered by restoration to archetype, is always a mortal, immortal world. The hero is never thoughtless. The hero is never quite wise enough. He is wiser than most, but falls victim to the strangest and most inconstant and inconsistent confusions, which is, again, perfectly natural to this state, because the hero moving is a being imperfect, trying to move beyond itself, trying always to achieve the unachieved, and therefore having no guide, and usually moving only upon emergency, surviving against the tremendous pressure of adversity. Now, the hero in the Greek is honored in various ways, usually by ultimate identity with the deities, and sometimes being returned as a constellation, a star or a heavenly body, which simply means restoration to archetype, becoming a star in the internal heaven of causes, in other words, returned to archetype. But in this mystery also, the Greeks were fully aware of the Oriental concept that the journey home is not only according to a law, but it is a journey from fragmentary existence to total existence. And that along the way of that journey to total existence, there must at one point, usually at the critical point, there must be an extraordinary change in events. Man moving toward totality reaches the point where totality begins to impress itself upon partial existence. The impact of these two things upon each other is very largely a matter of concern, at least symbolic concern, to the ascending being. Actually, this concern is from perspective only, inasmuch as Hercules dies. But Hercules is again restored and is carried back to the gods, where he becomes forever a great and venerable hero. He passes through death into immortality. But instead of passing through death into the darkness of earth to be reborn again, he now passes on into the celestial abodes and no longer is numbered with those who die. In this case, of course, the attainment of this immortality, implying as it does the attainment of a total impartile existence, that is, an existence without division, goes back to your Pythagorean mathematics. All things in which division exists are mortal. All things in which there are parts are susceptible to the rearrangement of those parts. Also, all things which exist in part have partile consciousness, and that is the only consciousness we know. We have a consciousness that exists not because of the fullness of itself, but because it is a specialization within an area of unconsciousness. Therefore, the heroic state actually means the individual transcending consciousness as he knows it, because the consciousness as he knows it is fragmentary. This is your Buddhistic nirvana. This is the extinction of the self. Unless the seed shall die, it shall not live again. This is the real mystery of the crucifixion and the resurrection. That all things, including the hero, must die. Because that which dies is the partial self. It is said in the ancient wisdom of Israel. That Moses ascended through the 49 gates, but the 50th gate he could not pass. And because he had angered the Lord by the smiting of a rock, when the time came, he was not permitted to enter into the land of Canaan, but was allowed to stand upon a mountain and look forth upon the land of Canaan. But Jehoshua, the son of Nun, led the children of Israel into the promised land. And upon the mountain, Moses, the hero, died and was taken to his God. And because God had promised that the angel of death should never come unto Moses, God came himself and took him. Now Moses is the hero, but the hero must die upon the hill of Moab, because another leader must carry the 12 tribes, the 12 parts, the 12 gods, the 12 departments of the soul, on into the nirvana, or into the total archetype. So the hero may approach the eternal, but can never know it. And the reason why the hero can never know the eternal is because the eternal may know only itself, and no other thing may know it. So there is this moment in which the self and all the attributes of its own nature, crucified between its own polarities, must die. And by so dying, save the whole world, the total self and the total being. Archetypally, this is the Logos of Plato, which impresses itself upon the universe in the beginning, in the form of the cross, and by dying at the time of creation, makes possible the redemption of all things. The Greeks had precisely the same concept, but the going home to the Greek, being the restoration of totality, meant the entry into an eternal, unconditioned state beyond mind or thought or concept, in which the personal self, the hero self, the attained self, perishes along with the unattained. And in the great battle of the gods in the Nordic literature, the gods and the evil spirits in the last great battle slew each other and all died together. Therefore, the hero self, the lower self, the demon, natal, and the sensual, all these finally come into a strange dissolution, for they are fragments. And the concept, the existence, the being of fragment, ceases when totality exists. So all parts die in totality. And in trying to preserve themselves, they preserve their own isolation and their own suffering. But in the complete sacrifice of themselves, they attain all. And those who would save their lives, lose them. And those who lose their lives for the sake of truth, shall have life everlasting. And it is this loss of life in truth that brings with it ultimately the restoration and resurrection of the firstborn of them that sleep. It is a very great mystery, but the Greeks were well aware of it. So now we have perhaps an understanding of Aesop's famous definition of the labor of the gods. Namely, that they are concerned principally with the raising up of the humble and the casting down of the great. The casting down of the great being, of course, the involutionary procedure in which that which was high, which was noble, which was archetypal, is reduced to the most humble state. And then the restoration or elevation of the meek being the lifting up of those from the earth, through the restoration of this golden ladder, or the great chain by which Zeus bound the world to the pinnacle of Olympus. All these legends and fables, therefore, have their own peculiar, rich significance. And to us in our present century, the simple thought that we are the hero, that we are the ones who are performing the labors, that our life is an expedition of Argonauts, that our wandering against the buffetings of the sea is our meeting the death of Poseidon, Lord of the Deep, whose great purpose is to bring us home to himself. That actually, the sorrows we pass through, the miseries we face, the burdens we carry, are simply those expressions forever reminding us that we are out of harmony with archetype. That which cannot fit into the eternal must be cast from it. As the Dionysian artificers, who first, before the stone could fit into the house, had to square it and perfect it, and remove all parts by which it was not suitable to be brought into union with other stones of similar purpose. So that the archetypal struggle that we know, the daily battle, is simply the individual removing those factors from his consciousness or from his experience by which he cannot go home. And these are removed in many ways. By Socrates and Plato, the concept was a joyous removal. And by others, it is a painful procedure. For the difference between wisdom and ignorance is that wise men love to do what fools are forced to do. There is no change in the order of things. But by gallantly understanding, and by relinquishing error without stress, by relieving ourselves of the tendency to defend our mistakes, but to move naturally and sequentially according to the order of our gods, each soul returns to its father star, according to the Greek pattern, and in the golden eras to come, beyond the contemplation of mortal men, all the heroes and all the great principles will feast together in the eternal field of the blessed. This, of course, is the field of the stars, the great universal mystery, for the stars are the symbols of archetypes, and the invisible universe is starred with them. For everywhere in space there are sunbursts of law unfolding and growing, and as these take form they become worlds, and as these formed worlds release themselves from forms they become souls. And when the release is sufficient, they become heroes. When the release is perfect, they become gods. And becoming gods, discover their identity with the great archetype rather than a separate existence in space. This concept, I think, is a brief summary of the Greek theology on that matter and how that is taken or was taken and mystically employed to create a philosophical system of disciplines. Will be, of course, the subject of the final lecture of this series next week on the same evening. And we thank you for being here.